This is The Conversation. It's episode 144 with Jim Gaylord, Brooklyn artist, and also is involved with several other projects, including Art Crit Zingers, which is a book project on hold. We talk about that. Also, a blog he has done called Art in the Movies, and his notorious email scammer project, in which he engages in extensive conversations with would-be email scammers who hit him up in the interest of buying his art, but in fact are trying to scam him out of his money. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, which you should go visit and check out Jim's work, as well as a couple of samples of the Art Crit Zingers and a snapshot from one of the email scam exchanges that he had. We perform one of those. Get to that in a minute. Last episode, 143, was with Huffington Post writer Priscilla Frank. I highly recommend that you listen to that episode. We talk about everything from outsider art, which she covers quite a bit for the Huff Post, as well as things like her article, Fuck Your Idols, What Celebrity Worship Reveals About Female Sexuality, which gave us the opportunity to finally talk about Rihanna, and we talk about Beyonce again, which is surprising considering she came up in the episode with Amanda Yates Garcia and my co-host Deb Cloud Mann, and Deb mentioned how horrified I was at the drop of the name even. But we talk about it. We talk about Beyonce, Rihanna, and Olivia Newton-John briefly as well. That is all revealed in the Priscilla Frank episode, so go check that out. Before we get to the episode with Jim Gaylord, I wanted to let you know that I went to a podcasting event earlier this week with Chris Ford, an artist who's been helping me on the podcast, and a couple takeaways that I want to share with you. One is we need more listeners, as if I didn't know that. I would love to grow more listeners still, and if you could help by spreading the word, of course, that would be fantastic. But I guess the other takeaway that is useful to you and us is the suggestion that came up for us and for other podcasters is creating a network, a podcast network. And if you're familiar with podcasts, you may have heard of a few of them. There's the Panoply Network, there's Maximum Fun, there is Earwolf, there are several others. Those are just a few that come to mind. But basically, it's a group of like-minded podcasts that share their leverage, share their listeners, spread the word, cross-promote. And so I want to know if you have any suggestions for podcasts that you're listening to that you think might make a good match. And with the preface being that I don't think the other art podcasts out there would make a good match. So maybe a film, literature, TV, opera, I don't know, podcast in the same vein as the conversation that you think might be good to join in partnership, in network with. So let me know if anything comes to mind. I'd appreciate any feedback on that. And all right, let's get to that conversation with Jim. First, I'll let you know that we do perform one of his most famous email scam exchanges with an email scammer that lasted over a month. And wanted to give you a heads up. I hope you listen to the whole thing and I hope you enjoy it, but I understand if you don't want to listen to the whole thing. So just FYI, once it starts, it lasts for about 12 and a half minutes before we kick back to the regular conversation. So just a heads up on that. Please stay tuned for the back end where I will talk to you some more and give you some more updates. Thank you so much for being here, for listening to the show. And go check out theconversationpod.com for images to go along with this episode. Thank you very much for being here. I will talk to you in the back end. And that is that you are in, are you in Fort Greene right now? Fort Greene, Brooklyn?
I'm technically in Clinton Hill. I live in Fort Greene, or right on the edge between Fort Greene and Clinton Hill, and right. My studio is in Clinton Hill, so mm-hmm. I'm in the studio now. It's about a block from the Navy Yards.
Mm. And then what is the latest with the Navy Yards? Aren't they, haven't they been redeveloped in a redeveloped phase for quite a while?
I feel like there's more and more happening there. I recently heard that Dudonne Paper Mill is relocating there, and I don't know if you're familiar with what they do, but
what are they called?
Dudonne Paper Mill, or paper making. They do a residency program, and they have exhibitions of paper-based art. So people make their own paper, and as an artist in residence, and it's something that I've applied for a few times. But they just moved literally a few blocks away from me, so I'm kind of excited about that. And yeah, there's always new things happening. Like, I know that there was the Democratic debate. I think it was the last one, took place in the Navy Yard. And so it's a lot of land there, a lot of space, and it's a little bit far away from public transportation. So to me, it's a little bit off the beaten path for people. But I think since it is such a wealth of space, they're you know, really trying to do as much as they can with it.
What about your studio and your house? Is that far from public transportation as well, or not so much?
I live directly across the street from the G train, which has a bad reputation. But since I live across the street from it, I can actually feel it in my bathroom. It's not as bad as some people perceive it to be. But my studio is about a 10-minute walk from there.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone is coming to my studio, they do have that 10-minute walk from the subway. But we've also got there's 47 Hall Street, which is about a half a block from here, and there's a lot of studios in there. So I feel like it's not off the radar in terms of being an artist neighborhood. I do run into artists I know all the time, and I see them in the grocery store.
Right,
it's kind of funny. Like, artists that I don't even know per se, but I see them, you know, buying bananas, you know, that artist.
Right. Isn't it funny when you see people who you don't know, but you've seen them before, you know, and you see them over and over again?
Yeah, I saw like Charlene Von Heil buying some fruit or something. I don't know what it was, but, you know, I was tempted to go up to her and be like, Ms. Von Heil, you know, but I held back from doing that.
Is she in your neighborhood too?
Well, I don't know why she was in there, because I don't know of her being here, but she was probably doing something at Pratt, or which is also about a block from here. But I just always assume that's what it is, if somebody is here that I don't usually see, because I haven't seen her since then. But
do you feel like certain curators, you know, who are a little bit more established or you know, maybe used to a certain kind of studio visit, that maybe it's harder to get some of them to make a trip if it involves a 10-minute walk from a subway? Or is that a little bit nearsighted to say that?
You know, I haven't had that problem. Mm-hmm. I feel like half of the studio visits I've had from galleries and curators, they end up taking a car or something anyway. So,
that's kind of where I was going.
it doesn't seem to be that much of a problem. And I don't know, I feel like in New York, people just, they make the effort to come out to whatever, you know, like whether it's a studio visit or an opening. I just feel like there's this sense that people don't let the transportation stand in the way too much. At least that's been my experience, which is good.
Yeah. So you moved from one city of intense gentrification, the Bay Area, or one area, to New York, another intense area of gentrification. I don't know. They're kind of they've kind of been racing alongside each other in a lot of ways.
Right.
And where you've been has changed pretty significantly. I mean, I guess they're, to just sort of set this up in a bigger way, they're kind of a category of Brooklyn neighborhood that have been not the Williamsburgs, you know, or Greenpoints even, but, you know, like Bedford-Stuyvesant is probably not too dissimilar from Fort Greene and Clinton Hill. Would you agree?
It's a little bit further down the road on the gentrification spectrum, I guess I would say. Like, it is definitely more expensive now than it was when I moved to New York. I moved to Fort Greene 11 years ago mm-hmm. in July, and I feel like it was already getting nice. But it was, you know, it was definitely still in a stage of getting that way. There was still, an edge to it. Like you wouldn't go to Fort Greene Park at night, you know, mm-hmm. for example, but now, dog owners bring their dogs there after 9 PM to let them off the leash. And it's like such a different situation.
And that's a function of the neighborhood of the residents more than the security, right?
Right. It's not like there's security, like police patrol in the park at night. But
yeah,
is that what you're asking?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's more just like people gather, you know, with their dogs, and it's dark, but I guess there's like an understanding that this is normal, you know, but there was this sort of awkward, byproduct of that is that people started complaining about the homeless people in Fort Greene Park yelling at their dogs for waking them up, you know? So it became this strange sort of, indirect form of insensitivity to, you know, the less polished side of the neighborhood.
Right.
So, you know, like they didn't have anywhere else to sleep. So they're sleeping in the park, and then dogs would come up to them and wake them up, and they would get testy, obviously, because you're being woken up when you were trying to sleep. So.
Yeah.
But so there was this rash of complaints about that happening. And it kind of seemed like this, silly, clash of interest, but
you know, I was just talking about this with somebody the other day about I guess a neighborhood or two in LA, but somebody should realize I'm sure some people have that it's actually big picture wise a benefit to have some homeless population around, because that is one of the last buffers to, you know, complete and utter Sohoization, isn't it?
I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because I just came back from San Francisco, and you know, as you mentioned, I lived there. I was there for 7 years before moving here, and I mean, it's just such a visible phenomenon there mm-hmm. compared to New York.
Right.
So I have a lot of conversations about homelessness whenever I go back to San Francisco, and I think about it a lot. I keep up with it from here. I read news stories about the latest insensitive thing that someone has said about the homeless, and then like the complexity surrounding that, mm-hmm. that, problem, you know, is that yes, it is a very difficult problem to solve. But it also seems like there's this in San Francisco, there's such a, competition for space in a smaller,
right.
In a smaller area. So I feel like it's more pronounced there. Whereas in New York, it's spread out. First of all, it's spread out over a larger city. Mm-hmm. And secondly, the climate here is not as conducive to living outside. So it doesn't make as much sense to sleep outside, you know, and people are, there's more of an effort made to get people off the streets in extreme weather. It's still a problem in New York, of course, but it's just much more noticeable, I think, on a visible level mm-hmm. in San Francisco. There are tent encampments there, which I don't see in New York. But it's in San Francisco, it's a very normal thing. It's like there's almost a culture of tent communities that, nobody knows how to deal with, you know, because there's nowhere else for me to go. But, you know, even Rainbow Grocery, which is this super compassionate, I feel, entity in San Francisco. It's a co-op, a worker-owned grocery store. And they were having trouble with homeless encampments around their loading area,
mm-hmm.
and it was interfering with their daily operations, and they had to say something to try to get that resolved. And you know, so when I heard that, I thought to myself, well, you know, it's really a problem if Rainbow Grocery is saying something.
Yeah.
But to bring it back to what you were saying, yeah. about being the last buffer toward gentrification in San Francisco, it seems like it hasn't functioned that way.
And, right.
But I think a lot of it has to do with the lack of knowledge that people have when they're moving into the Bay Area. Like they're not familiar with that history. It's almost like a legacy, I think, of San Francisco that it has this large homeless population.
Right.
That's why it catches my attention when I hear people speaking so insensitively about it. You know, of course it's a problem, but when there's a complete lack of understanding of it, I think one of the worst ones was somebody, you know, of course they worked in the tech industry, but I wouldn't ever blame like entire industry for this rise in unhelpful speech, but but something that someone said was, well, you know, the wealthy people have earned the right to live in this city, and we shouldn't have to see other people's pain and suffering on the way to work. It's a liability
right.
for these people to be here, you know. And I just heard, I read that, and I just thought, you know, this person they just got it all wrong, you
yeah.
know. Like, this is not the kind of person that needs to be the face of San Francisco. And,
yeah.
and so it really struck me.
The thing that you're making me wonder is if you take your typical San Francisco tech work, 26-year-old tech worker, you know, who's working, living in the city and working in the valley and getting, you know, taking one of the Twitter or Google buses or whatever, versus your typical, you know, 26-year-old in one of the, you know, already gentrified or gentrifying neighborhoods of Brooklyn, how much difference is there going to be, you know, in their sensitivities? Like, your average young New York person is not necessarily going to be acquainted with the homeless history either, right?
Right, because they're, you know, they're not confronted with it. So,
yeah,
I guess it's just a case of someone's true self coming out when faced with the adversity or faced with the conflict. You know, you just don't, they're not exposed to it.
Right. If you just look at New York, though, the hunger or the need for real estate, the demand, rather, for real estate is such that, you know, the homelessness population, quote-unquote, buffer is maybe not that significant. I think that's kind of what you sort of were implying when you were talking about that situation in San Francisco.
Right. There's you're saying that there's less of that to prevent gentrification from happening.
No, I'm just saying I'm just saying it doesn't really matter. Even if there was a lot of it, the demand for rentals and co-ops is just too great for that to make an impact.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing it all around my neighborhood. But literally like around my neighborhood, like Fort Greene is a historic district. So we don't have high rise luxury condos like popping up within our neighborhood, but all around the periphery of it, they are. And it's almost like we're being turned into like this fortress historic architecture, you know, by these luxury condos. So it's always within a stone's throw.
I feel
like, you know, so we are still seeing it here. I feel fortunate that my studio is in a building that doesn't appear to be in the path of a, you know, the steamroller of gentrification, just because my landlord cares about artists and she wants artists to be here and making their work, and she gets offers all the time for people wanting to buy it, and it's a beautiful building and she could sell it in a heartbeat, but that, you know, fortunately for us, that's not her priority.
Yeah.
You know, she wants this to be an artist's studio building.
Yeah, and so, you mentioned when we spoke earlier how people you know were asking you about studio spaces, and I was wondering, both with your this great studio situation it sounds like you have, but also even with your living, how lucky you feel like you've been as far as, you know, finding this particular studio, but also just the timing, you know, of when you came to New York and, you know, like that you got it in the nick of time or those kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like I didn't get to New York early enough to buy something super cheap. So that didn't happen. But I did get a rent-stabilized apartment, which I'm holding on to as long as I can, and it's also within walking distance. So that that worked out, you know. And then I found this studio on Craigslist, which was
amazing.
Pretty random, really. Yeah, I mean, imagine finding an affordable studio on Craigslist now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do. I feel super lucky in that sense. Because I was, you know, if I was sharing a studio with someone in Dumbo, then had to move out of there, and then painting in my bedroom, and you know, so I knew I needed a separate space to work because I didn't want to have just this compartmentalized living space where I would just basically leave my apartment, walk around the block, and pretend I was going somewhere else. And then come back home and start working. And that was when I lived in a different apartment with a roommate. But now I live in a studio apartment and I walk to my studio. So
right. That's great.
I have that mental separation.
Yeah.
Between living and working.
So you had a situation where you were painting in your bedroom when you had the roommate?
Right.
And so you would go leave the apartment, walk around the literal block, come back, and it was like, oh, I've just left my home, and now I'm in my working space.
Yes. Yeah, I needed to have some kind of barrier, some kind of dividing line between, you know, didn't want to just, like, wake up, sit up, and then poop, and then, you know, start painting, you know. So it was just, I needed a little bit more of a mental compartmentalization of those two things.
I wonder if there's any correlation between working where you're living and the work that you've been making as far as your painting, because I know that this, you have this show up now as we speak in San Francisco that is cut paper. Right. And, you know, some of it's painted, but before it sounds like you were doing just oil on canvas. Right. So I wonder if at any point the studio situations affected, you know, the mediums that you're using.
Well, when I just going back a little further in San Francisco, when I first started painting seriously, I guess in 2000 or 1999, I was painting in my bedroom then too, and I was painting with oil, which is not a good thing to do, really.
No.
But when I moved to New York, I did kind of tailor the sort of work I was making according to the space that I had available to work in. So when I had a studio space before I moved back into my bedroom, I was painting with oil. Then when I moved back into my bedroom to work, I was only doing small gouache on paper work. And then since I've had the studio space for past 8 years, I guess, I've done a combination. Right now I'm focusing on work that's made out of cutout paper that's painted with gouache. So, and sometimes spray paint, you know, but that's, it's not necessarily because of any caution of toxicity. It's just because that's what I want to do.
Yeah, got it.
You know, like I'm less interested in working with oil paint right now.
Right.
Because the ideas that I have are not conducive.
So when did you, you have this history of these side projects, and maybe we can come up with a better term, but these online projects that are art related, and you maybe can give me the chronology. But there's the Art Crit Zingers website. There's the Art in the Movies, which you pointed me to, and then there are these these scam mini plays that you have done. Were those kind of all going on at the same time, or did they have they kind of come in phases, or how's that worked?
I think that they were sort of all concurrent, and some of them are more in the back burner than others. The Art Crit Zingers project is kind of on the back burner right now, but I still think it's a funny idea, and you know, it's just I was working on that with a curator who I'm friends with, and I had posted something on social media about I think it would be funny to release a book of zingers from graduate school critiques, and so this curator Gerardana Zeldin took me seriously, and she contacted me. She said we should do this, and I was like, oh, I was just kidding, and she said, no, let's have coffee. And so you know, we talked about doing it, and it just, you know, I actually thought it was a fun idea, and you know, just the collaboration, an artist and a curator working together on something that was kind of exposing what we really wanted to do was just to kind of think about the way people talk to artists about their work.
Yeah.
And you know, and also just kind of talk about the way that everybody hears this type of thing.
Right.
Especially from an early point in their career. So, you know, that was where that came from.
Well, while we're there, why don't let's visit some of them. And I want to take the opportunity as briefly as well while we're on Art Crit Zingers. That's a bit of a mouthful. Remind people and introduce people like yourself, probably, who aren't familiar, that one of the sort of subsets of the conversation is this thing called We'll Call You, as in Don't Call Us. And the idea behind that, it comes sort of in the same spirit as Art Crit Zingers, except it's not as specific, and that kind of maybe is one of its weaknesses, but it's basically people's anecdotes that generally come out of the school of the bad studio visit. So rather than like the specific line, it's like what happened in this really disastrous studio visit, or it could be even something, you know, sort of bigger picture, but similar sort of vibe, like Patty Johnson shared this story where she had this really horrible travel experience. You know, it could be anything along those lines. And it's favoring something more open-ended and audio-based than, you know, something in text. So all that to say that I just wanted to mention that for people who aren't familiar, but I wanted to just mention some of the favorites that I picked out from your Art Crit Zingers site. So the first one is, it's just, I have like a handful of them. What's the difference between your work and a rock? Said to Michael Mihaljic. I'm not interested in your political ideas, but I am interested in the way this looks, said to Nicole Van Beek. Don't you feel like making objects is selfish? Said to Zachary Pritchard. I like to take a sander to my work. You should take a sander to these, said to Larissa Bates. That's got to be a classic.
Want to point out that Larissa's, she's a very dear friend of mine, and her paintings are very intricate oil paintings.
Oh, wow.
And they're very, like almost like miniature paintings. So
happen to know who said that to her? Is that something we're allowed to mention, or is that, do they have to remain anonymous?
I don't know, but that was part of the framing of the project, is that we wouldn't expose anyone for whatever they said. It was more about just thinking about the zinger itself,
right,
and the person who it was said to, and
right.
So it definitely was not an accusation or a witch hunt.
Right, right, right. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me do another handful more, and we'll finish with one that you had, and you can talk about what that was like. That piece is the artistic equivalent to a dead fish handshake, said to Dominic Nuri. I would think about this work totally differently if I thought you had any idea what you're doing, said to Eames Armstrong. You must be having a hard time in this program, given all the narcissistic self-portraiture that you do, said to Mariah Robertson, who, for people who don't know, is a pretty big star right now. This is really lame. Don't get me wrong. It's important, but it's seriously lame, said to Brandy Bahalia. And then here's yours. I had a couple more, but I'm just going to get to yours. I want to run away from this painting, said to Jim Gaylord. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, that was during grad school. And that was the impetus for the project. And I was just actually working in my studio here, 10 years later, hardly ever thought about that experience. But in that case, I the person was right, I think sometimes it's hard to hear these things about our work, but in the end we needed to hear them. And she even gave me like an escape. Like she said, well, hey, are you sure you really want me in your critique today? And I said, yeah, why not? And yeah, so it was a friendly enough nudge. But yeah, of course, having it said to you in front of a room full of like 15 people is hard. But I learned from it. I feel like the criticisms that followed the zinger were valid. And I took them to heart in my next painting. That painting ended up in the dumpster. And a classmate of mine tried to dig it out of the dumpster and save it. And I told him to put it back in the dumpster. So, because it belonged in the dumpster.
The painting that will not die.
Yeah. So it points to just someone's perspective. Like to him, it was, a treasure dumpster dive from a dumpster dive. But to me, it was a lesson that I had to learn and then let go of.
Well, what was, articulate how it was a painting that one should feel like they need to run away from. What exactly does that mean?
Well, I mean, one thing about it was that it was super trendy looking. There were things that I was doing in the painting that you could just really point to popular tropes from current painting at the time. And there was also something with the scale of it that wasn't working. Like I was literally enlarging a sketch that I had made into a big 7-foot painting, but not really thinking about what happens when you take the scale of a 8.5 by 11 drawing and blow it up to 7 feet, because it's not the same when you do that. You have to understand what happens to an image when you blow it up that big. Yeah. And I didn't understand that at that point. And in hearing this criticism of the painting, it encouraged me to, push myself harder to figure out why it failed, And I may not have done that if it had been just a pat on the back and, like, oh, it's pretty, nice job, And I don't think that's the role of grad school or a critique anyway, to give you a pat on the back. And I had other people come in, and I was having a show coming up right very close to this critique, and an artist came in, someone that I had invited to my studio, who was a very well-known painter and someone I still admire today, and she said, are you sure you're ready to show? And it was kind of hard to hear that, and but she was, she was right. I wasn't really ready.
So where were you going to be showing that somebody thought you were ready?
Well, it was, I don't want to say because I think it's sort of one of those things where, they saw something that, appealed to them, or that they saw something promising, that this other person didn't see. But
it was a commercial gallery.
Yeah.
And they were offering you, giving you a show while you were still in graduate school.
Right. Which, you know, I feel like that is tricky because,
yeah.
there's a phenomenon in New York as well. You know, like, there were always, criticisms of curators going to, Columbia University
yeah.
MFA openings and cherry picking people, from thesis show and then putting them in solo shows in the gallery. And in a way it was enabled by the art market because, those people were, celebrated, you know, for being young and fresh and, you know, like it was almost like the freshness of it, and the youthfulness of it was more important than mm-hmm. whether or not the work was good.
Right.
You know, and sometimes it was good and fresh.
Right.
You know, fresh not always being good, but new, someone new doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it, so it's not always a mistake, but I think that, just, I don't know. I mean, I look back to that show and I think that there were things that I would have done differently, which I am doing differently now, but it's, I guess there are always decisions that you make, you know, when you're putting work out into the world, like you have to decide that you're ready to do it. And when you're, younger, you know, this was a long time ago, you may not have the information, that you really need to make an informed choice, but
right.
you choose to do it because, I mean, frankly, it's hard to say no to a show
yeah.
when you're in grad school, because all you want is to show.
Yeah.
And then someone gives you that opportunity, and it would take a very thoughtful, patient person to turn it down, which I wasn't at the time. But I think that's the other thing about grad school is that it can feel like a very artificially sped up bubble where everything is supposed to happen a certain way. And, you know, it's, instead of happening naturally. So we kind of go into the experience, having to acclimate to this sped up, cycle,
mm-hmm.
you know, sped up track. And so since we know that the goal after grad school is to show, you know, I don't think there was really anyone in grad school telling me not to show, but except for this one artist who came in as a guest artist. But it can be very easy to be seduced by that
yeah.
opportunity.
And so you had the show, and even though in some ways you might admit you weren't ready, it didn't become a barrier or a really strategically bad move in retrospect.
No, I don't think so.
Mm.
I don't think so.
Right. Okay, so let's switch over to the scam project, for lack of a better term. What was the exchange? I imagine you had an initial exchange of some kind that sort of launched that. What was that happened?
Well, I think that, you know, and I'll preface it by saying, like, I get a lot of these, and more than anyone that I've ever met. I don't know why. I first started getting them when I was trying to sell a desk that my father had left me after he passed away on Craigslist. And I started writing back to them more like, are you kidding? Like, this is already a difficult enough time and you're trying to steal from me, you know?
Yeah.
So I started, the leading them on kind of, absurd narrative thing, trying to sell a desk, but they weren't as engaging as the art scams. They mm-hmm. they were kind of, I don't know if they were just in more of a hurry or the stakes were lower, but the first, I think one of the very first ones that started it was probably still my favorite one, which just because the scammer seemed to really believe everything that I was saying. And I would post it to social media. People would read my responses, and it almost became like this serial story
right.
that they would have to wait for the next installment. And it got a lot of egging on, you know, from my friends, like, you know, keep it going. And so just the sheer encouragement from other people, definitely had a lot to do with following up with the others, but then I continued to get them.
And why do you think you've been a target or, you know, I mean, how does one artist's work get chosen to, you know, be scammed versus another's?
You know, I really just don't know. I'm on a couple of artist registries where first I was on the artist space registry when that was a thing. And then I'm on the White Columns registry. And, but so I think that's one of the main ways that they find you. I just saw this thing that happened. Like in grad school, I was contacted by a man in London who a lot of people thought he was a scammer because he has this autistic son named Anthony, who he said loves your work. And if you would, you know, have a drawing or a sketch that we could buy from you, he would really love it. And so my teacher was like, oh, it's a scam. I got that too. But I was in grad school. I sent him a drawing. I was like, why not? You know, and then he sent me, I didn't ask him to pay for it. And then he sent me some little drawings and I just thought it was sweet. And, I actually have been in touch with this person since then. And he ended up being the subject of an episode of This American Life.
I remember. Where, yeah. It's coming back to me as you're talking about it.
Yeah. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they went and visited his house in London and there was this sort of air of suspicion, about it. And, you know, I contacted him. I said, you know, I just heard you on This American Life. It's so interesting. Like, I guess there's been a lot of confusion about what you're doing and whether or not Anthony exists. But, you know, I wondered how you felt about it. And he said, well, yeah, I think they did a really good job of portraying the story. You know, some people just believe it's a scam, and I can't really change their minds. But, you know, Anthony, I believe Anthony exists, and I believe this is a real father-son family, and that the son likes art, and I just said, well, you know, as long as you're not selling them for a profit, I'm fine with whatever, you know, as long as you're not taking this collection that you're accumulating and flipping it, and if that's not your intention, then, you know, then I'm happy that it brings joy to you.
Right, know? Right.
So that was the first kind of introduction I had to the possibility of being scammed. And like I said, I don't really believe that was a true scam, but, I don't know to answer your other question. Like why me more than somebody else? For a while I thought that they just had some kind of list that they were circulating. Now I feel like they put me on a list of do not contact these people because, I accidentally sent one of them a link to the Facebook page where I was, and I don't know how that happened. I was just like copying an address or something, like a fake address to send them, and or a phone number, and ever since then, that was almost a year ago, I haven't received one. So then I ended up having a friend forward one to me that I ghost wrote for her. Mm-hmm. And that was the last one that I did. I think there's been about six and all that have progressed to the stage of where I've been able to create a story, right. Like a mini play, as you said.
Right. And just to edify me and people listening, what is it that they need from you to actually scam you? Do you like the ideas that you keep having an exchange and you, the scammy, inadvertently give them some kind of bank information, and that's where they get what they need?
Well, the traditional way that it seems to work is that they send a check to you for more than the amount of the artwork, and then they ask you to give the difference to what they refer to as a shipping agent,
right?
Who is apparently going to ship their belongings. They're always moving somewhere. It's always like a surprise for their wife, and they're moving somewhere.
Yeah.
So there's this need to ship a large amount of things, which justifies the huge discrepancy in the money, you know, and the price of the artwork and the money they actually give you. So, and then that check bounces that they give you, and you've wired money to them or given money to someone.
Right.
I've never gotten to the point where I have obviously given money to anyone, but I did get them to FedEx a check to me once and to a fake address, and it was delivered. We tracked it. A friend of mine actually tracked it when I posted it on Facebook. I said, "Oh, that was delivered." And so I know that there is money exchange. Like, it, you know, they're serious about doing this, because I think that part of it is they see that you're going along with it, and they want to do it real fast because they don't want you to catch on. And then they, you know, they think that artists, I think, are more gullible, or more, maybe they think that they're more likely to believe something in order to make a sale. And that's kind of, you know,
right.
Annoying that they're preying on artists, who are traditionally not known as being super wealthy
yeah.
individuals. So,
yeah.
So in a way, I think of it almost like a public service that I'm doing,
yeah.
because I'm wasting their time. And then, in the last case, I actually did report a credit card number, a stolen credit card number that they were using. And the bank said that they were going to contact the client. And I do sometimes even get people contacting me that have been told to ask me if something that they've received is a scam.
Mm.
So it's just funny how the word has gotten around within my circle of friends.
Like, right.
You know, ask Jim.
Jim is the art scam expert that you need to get in touch with. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but I really think of them as an opportunity for creative writing.
Well, speaking of which, I think that's a perfect segue into, should we do Dancing Asparagus then?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be the scammer and you're going to be yourself?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, got it. Okay. So here we go.
Okay.
Hello, my name is James Grillo from South Carolina. My wife and I have our wedding anniversary coming up soon. I noticed she viewed your website recently on my laptop, and I guess she likes your piece of work. I'm also impressed and amazed to have seen your various works, too. You are doing a great job. I would like to receive further information about your piece of work and what inspires you. I am interested in the purchase of the piece, in subject field above, to surprise my wife. Kindly confirm the availability of immediate sales. Thanks and best regards, James.
Dear James, I'm so sorry for the delayed response. I dropped a VCR on my foot and had to go to the ER. I got an MRI, and fortunately everything is fine. Thanks for your nice words about my art, and I'm flattered your wife likes my piece of work. Believe it or not, the painting that you inquired about was actually made by fastening paint-soaked sponges to Cocker Spaniels and letting them roll around on a canvas. It's a very special piece, and smelly. The cost is $1,924.13 plus freight. Please let me know if you are interested, as I have another couple from North Carolina interested in the same piece. All the best and happy holidays, Jim.
Dear Jim, thanks for the message. However, I'm so sorry about your feet. I'm glad you are okay now. I must tell you I intend to give my wife a surprise with the immediate purchase of the piece. Also, if you'd like to know, I am relocating to the Philippines soon, and our wedding anniversary is fast approaching, so I'm trying to gather some good stuff to make this event a surprise one. I am buying the piece as part of gifts to her quickly before someone else grabs it. I am okay with the price, and I will be sending a check. As regarding shipping, you don't have to worry about that in order not to leave any clue to my wife for the surprise. As soon as you receive and cash the check, my shipping agent, who is also moving my personal effects, will contact you to arrange pickup. I would have come to purchase this piece myself, but at the moment, I'm on a training voyage to the North Atlantic Ocean. I'm an ocean engineer, with new hires who are fresh from graduate school and won't be back for another couple of weeks. P.S. This is really hard to read straight-faced.
I know.
P.S. In the meantime, kindly get back to me with your full name, phone number, and contact address where a check can be mailed to so I can get the check prepared and have it mailed out to you right away. James.
Dear James, thanks for your concern about my foot. It doesn't hurt anymore, but it's so purple from bruising, you might mistake it for an eggplant. My VCR no longer works, though. It might take me a few more days to send that piece you inquired about. My gallery has informed me that it is currently in an exhibition called Works of Arft, Paintings by and About Dogs. See my previous email. I had no idea, but it sounds like a fun show, and my Cocker Spaniels, Lucy and Mordecai, are thrilled. The show ends this week, so I can have it ready for pickup by Friday. If you would prefer not to wait, perhaps there is another painting on my website you would like, such as Werewolf Grandma, 2010, oil on canvas, or Mermaid with Cowboy Boots, 2011, oil on canvas. That one has a maritime theme, which may interest you since you are an ocean engineer. In any case, let me know if you would rather wait for the first painting you asked about. Do you need my studio address or my home address for the check? Best wishes, Jim.
Hi, Jim. I'm glad your foot is okay. Thanks be to God. I'm sure very soon the bruise shall fade off. Mistaking it for an eggplant is quite hilarious. Friday is still very okay. I'm cool with that. You can send me your home address so that the check could be mailed as soon as possible. Thanks, James.
Hello, James. Indeed, my foot is feeling very blessed, but I have bad news about the painting. It seems some cat burglars broke into the gallery where the dog art show is being held and stole my piece. They also took a watercolor made by a golden retriever and peed on the floor. It's terrible. The detectives are saying that the thieves cut a big hole in the window with a glass cutter and crawled right in. Would you be willing to take Dancing Asparagus with Underpants, 2012, oil on canvas instead? It looks basically exactly almost the same as the other one, and I can sell it for half the price, $962.06. I'm sure your wife will still be surprised. I hope this is okay with you. Please let me know, and I'll send you my home address. It would also be great to make the sale so I can pay for all the medical expenses from my foot injury and buy a new VCR. Sincerely, Jim.
Dear Jim, thanks for the message. I'm so sorry about the incident, and I hope the culprits are apprehended soon enough. It's okay. I will go for the piece Dancing Asparagus with Underpants 2012 oil on canvas. I like it, and the price is fair enough. I am okay with the price $962.06. I'm so sorry about all that has happened to you.
Hello, James. Sorry for the lapse in communication. I have been to the police station helping to identify the cat burglars who stole my piece, and we think we may have nabbed them. Their names are Whiskers McGraw and Fleabag Johnson. I have never seen cats this big and mean before, and Officer Barkley says he hasn't either. Now that we have solved the mystery, I can turn my attention back to this sale. You can send the check to P.O. Box 2121, Brooklyn, New York, and I'll let you know when I receive it. Happy anniversary. P.S. Officer Barkley recovered my painting from the cat burglars, which is intact except for a few scratches from their paws. Do you want to buy that one now, or will you still go with Dancing Asparagus with Underpants, 2012 oil on canvas?
Hello, Jim. Thanks for the details, which I've noted down. I am glad you recovered your stolen piece. Good job from the police, but I'm no longer interested in it. I'm good with Dancing Asparagus with Underpants. I will make the check just as you have instructed, and I hope to visit your studio with my wife in the nearest future after our anniversary. Also, in order not to leave any clue to my wife for the surprise, I've contacted a client of mine to issue out a check, which will include my shipping agent fees to you, so you may have to help remit the balance to the shipping agent as soon as the check clears your bank. I would have handled this much differently if I'd been at home, but I'm a bit pressed for time and do not have access to a lot of cash over here. Trying to kill two birds with a stone. Jim, I want you to understand that I'm concluding you are a responsible person. I can therefore entrust you with this arrangement. Please, I will appreciate it if you get back to me ASAP to know if I can entrust you with this transaction. Many thanks and talk to you soon. James.
James, apologies for the delay. I was seriously hungover for like a whole day. But yeah, I am definitely a totally responsible person all the time. Except for that time I took my Cocker Spaniels to Vegas and lost them in the Golden Nugget. They still haven't forgiven me for that. Lucy just gave me that look. I don't want to get involved with helping you kill birds with rocks. I don't know what you're doing that for, but that's your business, so whatever. I'm sure I can handle sending the extra money to the shipping agent. once I get it. I still haven't gotten it, though.
Hello, Jim. You still have not given me an address where the check can be mailed to. I'm so glad I can rely on you for the surprise. Once again, thanks for your help, James.
Hello, James. I have a situation. Whiskers McGraw, the cat who stole my painting, has escaped from jail and now he's on the loose. I can't stay at my place for fear of retaliation, so I need you to send the check to my neighborhood drugstore, Walgreens, 379 Myrtle Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11205. Don't worry, they know me there. They always have a bottle of Demerol and a pack of certs waiting for me when I come by. And they said they could hold my mail for me until the coast is clear. I hope you understand I can't take any chances. I heard Whiskers once killed a guy over a bag of catnip and then buried him in kitty litter. It's really effed up. If you don't want to send it to Walgreens, my friend I'm staying with said you could send it to his house. Oliver C. Peanut, 62 Lewis Avenue, number 4, Brooklyn, New York, 11238. Please don't tell anyone where I'm staying, though. Thanks for your understanding.
Hello, okay. Corey. I'm sorry for responding to your message this late. It has been a busy time for me, despite the fact that it's Christmas season. Please pardon me, the payment has not been made till now. Consider the piece sold to me already, and I assure you that the check will be mailed out to you this week. I hope it is okay if the check is mailed out to Oliver C. Peanut, 62 Lewis Avenue, number 4, Brooklyn, New York, 11238. Thanks, Merry Christmas, and a prosperous New Year, James. P.S. Sorry about the name, it's my daughter's. She's been giving me a tough time. Please rest assured that I'm not going to give out your address to anyone. You can count on that. And I hope the issue has been resolved already, as you deserve to live freely. I wish you all the best, Jim. James.
Hello, James. Not to worry. Corey was the name of my very first German Shepherd. Brings back memories.
Dear Jim, compliment of the season. Hope you are doing great. Just a quick update. The check has been mailed out and will be delivered today to the address given via FedEx. You would please recall that I explained in my email earlier that the shipping agent is also helping me move some of my properties along with the piece. Specifically, he will be moving my 1932 Ford Roadster and some personal effects. So the balance on the check is to cover the shipping fees. Kindly keep me posted as soon as you receive the check so I can give you the shipper's information and instructions on how to forward the overage to the shipping agent. Thanks, and I await to read from you, James.
Thanks for the update, James. I will tell Mr. Peanut to keep an eye out for the check as I am keeping a low profile today, hiding. Thanks.
Once again, thanks a bunch for doing this. I really appreciate it, and I hope the burglar is apprehended soon so that you can live free. Till then, please take care of yourself, James.
James, hello. I have some bad news about the painting you wanted to buy, Dancing Asparagus with Underpants 2012 Oil on Canvas. My dog ate it. I don't know how Mordecai got into the shipping crate, but don't worry, he is being severely punished, and I have dressed him up like a baby to remind him of how immature he behaved. I might be able to send you bits and pieces of the painting, but I won't know for another 8 to 12 hours. It probably won't smell very good, so I'll wrap it up tight in a Ziploc bag and send it to you. What is your mailing address? Can I still cash the check? Best wishes, Jim.
Well, Jim, my friend, I want to believe and trust you wouldn't disappoint. I'm sure the painting will be dry before it gets to its destination, no doubt about that. You go ahead and cash the check and proceed with the transaction. And please take it easy on Mordecai. I know you're going to make everything work out. Thanks, James.
Hi, James. I just wanted to make sure you understood from my last message that my dog ate the painting and it is currently breaking down somewhere inside his digestive system. Thoughts?
Dear Jim, I really don't know what you want me to do as you have been so careless with the painting. Could I still buy another painting in place of the one the dog ate? If yes, you can go ahead and cash the check, only if it is at the same range with the one I intended to purchase. James.
James, I'm in serious trouble. I've been kidnapped by Whiskers McGraw. He finally caught up to me, and he's making me write this email because he wants a ransom of $10,323.67 for my release. He found all my emails to you on my laptop, so he thinks you have a lot of money. I have no one else to turn to since I'm just a starving artist. Can you please help me, James? Whiskers turned my friend Mr. Peanut into peanut butter. P.S. I told Whiskers you are an ocean engineer, and now he wants you to send him 900 cans of sardines. And then some time passes when I don't hear from him. Dear Mr. Grillo, this is Jim Gaylord. Someone hacked into my Hotmail account and has been sending messages to you, pretending to be me. I don't use this email address very often, so I just noticed it. I don't have a painting for sale called Dancing Asparagus with Underpants, so maybe I should make one.
Okay, did you receive the check I sent? Kindly let me know ASAP. Thanks, James.
Hello, Mr. Grillo. No, I don't know who has been writing to you, and I don't know whose address they gave you. Perhaps you would be interested in another painting? I would hate to lose a sale just because of some dishonest person. And I'm still awaiting a reply.
So that's the end of the chain.
That was the end of that one. It lasted over a month. It really drug it out.
And you performed this in front of an audience, correct?
Right. A friend of mine who enjoys the scam emails asked me to perform it at a salon that she hosts called Dead Darlings at Judson Memorial Church. So that was fun. I don't really consider myself a performer, but
right.
I don't really know exactly where exchanges fit into what I do overall, but it just, I don't know, it's entertaining.
Cathartic?
It's cathartic, but I think it's gone beyond the point of being cathartic, and it's just more like I like doing it because I think it's funny.
Right.
And I just, you know, I feel like there's so much stuff that people post that on social media that's like, I don't know, either like self-promotional or bad news or whatever. I think it's just kind of funny to have this release where I get to be someone else. You know, I get to kind of step into the shoes of this person. And then, and like I mentioned, like a friend of mine asked me to ghostwrite for her. I think she was kind of joking when she asked me, but I said, yeah, I'll do it. And so I was just writing as her, and that one involved her slowly turning into a vampire. And then, absurd, you know.
There was at least from one curator, demand for the Art Crit Zingers being turned into a book. Do you think there's any interest or market for a scam email exchange book?
It's interesting because a friend of mine someone I've met recently who is more of a friend of a friend, but she likes the emails and she wanted to send them to her publisher. She's a novelist. And I think that the feedback was that he liked them, but he was more interested in seeing them with some kind of illustrations. And I don't consider myself an illustrator, so not really sure exactly what the best road to go down with these letters would be, but I'm still kind of trying to figure out what they're going to turn into. And I think something beyond just, you know, posting them on social media, but I haven't figured it out yet. So it's a bit of an anomaly right now. I'm not really sure where they're going to lead, but it's, like I said, just creative writing exercise.
Right. More creative writing exercise than vigilantism.
Yes. For sure.
Right. Do you see your work as anywhere in the realm of sort of the explosion of abstraction that's been going on over the last several years?
Sure.
Okay,
yeah.
So if the answer is anywhere near yes, then I get to ask you my classic conversation podcast question, which is, what do you feel about the explosion of abstraction that's been going on?
Well, I almost feel like it's imploding a little bit right
okay.
now. I mean, I almost feel like there's a little bit more of an interest in figuration again.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, there was of course the whole zombie formalism dealio, and you know, people like having to defend them, what they were doing with that, and I think a lot of like mimicry, you know, people seeing what other people were doing, like unfortunately just like thinking that was what they were supposed to do, so they would do that too. And but lately I feel like there's more of I'm seeing more of a focus on figuration.
And when you say you're seeing it, when you say you're seeing it, where are you seeing it? In other words, is that coming from all in-person media and so on, or is that, you know, what are the scopes that you're using for that assessment?
Well, I know that there was that thing that Jeffrey Deitch did at Art Basel last year, like a figure-centric show. And I think that there's just there's a pull away from the people thinking that abstraction was as cool as it was. Now I feel like there people thinking more about Nicole Eisenman and other contemporary figurative painters. But I think it's more just that there isn't as much of a push to imitate what people were doing, or there was maybe it's even a backlash against the whole zombie abstraction phenomenon.
Right.
So I think that it's just less of a trendy thing to do.
Yeah.
But I kind of feel like people just have to do what they do regardless of what's trendy.
Right. I wonder though if part of the subtext of your what you say you've been seeing is even includes seeing that people are moving towards figuration, you know, because of that it's becoming trendy again, or because it's the winds are blowing in that direction.
Well, I mean, one thing I think that has really come into play with the way people are seeing art and digesting art is Instagram. You know, I think that people want to do something that is going to, I mean, this isn't, and I'll preface this by saying, I don't think this is necessarily a good thing, but people want to do something that's going to be Instagrammable.
Right.
So I think that if there is very brightly colored abstraction, then that will be Instagrammable.
Right.
And if there's something that someone will look good in front of taking an art selfie, that's, you know, and someone mentioned to me recently, it's like, you know, here's the secret. Just do something that people are going to want to take their picture in front of. I think it was my friend Sarah Kane actually said this to me. And you know, that'll end up on Instagram, and that's what people want, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just, I mean, it is kind of a problem, right? Like the way that people consume images, you know, just being on the phone or,
yeah,
you know, so like the idea of something being tailored to be seen only on that format, I think is kind of a depressing direction. But I think it's sort of unavoidable, right?
Do you think that gallerists and curators are, you know, in overall heading in that direction where they're favoring more reproducible / Instagrammable imagery?
I will say I don't know if I would say that, but I will say that I think that there is less of a focus right now on brick and mortar spaces, and just because of that, because things are seen online so frequently, and also just because of the high price of brick and mortar spaces.
Yeah,
you know. And there's people are seeing more shows just on websites and buying more work from art fairs, and there's less of a sense that, oh, you know, you have to see this work in person, which is kind of challenging for me because I feel like whenever someone sees my work in person, they're like, oh, I had no idea it looked so three-dimensional. That's just the problem of a JPEG is that it flattens images out. And it's been a challenge to try to convey that on the internet.
I just saw a show over the weekend, and I was revisiting it on the gallery's website, and the pictures I took on my phone gave more of an idea of what the work was like than the, you know, these face on shots that they had on their website. And it was, you know, it was, I was pretty surprised, but I just wanted to mention that in passing. But also, so you kind of answered my earlier question, which I didn't say, which was that it sounds like your work is not super Instagrammable.
Well, there's the layer of plexiglass, which is one barrier. And, you know, I think that when I'm Instagramming something that I'm working on, I try to do a detail just so that people can get closer. And it's like I just use my Instagram as basically like a studio journal.
Right.
And it does, it sheds that, perspective that they wouldn't get to see just from a full shot. I mean, that's one issue that I've been dealing with. Like the current show that I have up now, there's also a lot of work that is not even painted. It's paper that's just unpainted and layered on top of itself to create these sort of three-dimensional, almost like reliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all white, you know, so it's definitely not like a colorful image, but, and then that I feel like is a much more tactile object.
Right.
You know, it's not necessarily sexy on Instagram because it's monochromatic and it's something that's more about, details that you have to pick up on from light and shadow. And
yeah. So getting back to Instagram, you said that the shots you take are kind of like a studio log of, you know, what you're working on. So what, so this is not something I've really asked people on the show, what are the pros and cons to you taking shots of your work and putting them on Instagram? I mean, is there any downside to doing it? And I'll just say before you answer that, certainly it's very common for people to use both Facebook and or Instagram to show updates of what's going on in their studio. I think that can feel to some people who are viewing these things as a little showboaty or, you know, kind of TMI a lot of the time. Mm. I know that fans, you know, like diehard fans of that artist, you know, that's what they want, but that's, you know, I just wanted to set it up that way. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't just do that. I try to, you know, I started doing Instagram just because I liked taking little pictures of things that I saw on the street that were
sure.
funny. So it's usually both that or like a friend's work that I think is really cool, you know, but it becomes like a visual journal, like just
right.
images that interest me. And sometimes I like to go back and look at the images together and I'll find unexpected correlations between mm-hmm. things that I posted, you know, like, oh, there's this radial pattern that I was working on in the studio. And I went to Woodstock the next weekend and there was a spiral staircase that I, you know, photographed. So I don't know. It's kind of interesting to look at the connections between the images that you capture. So I try not to just make it about my work.
Sure.
You know, but
yeah, I mean, think that's what it sounds
it's
like.
It's a little bit of an outlet, you know,
it's
just kind of a fun, little project, you know, I think it's, there's just so many ways to use Instagram. I mean, some people use it to fish for compliments about how they look, you know, and there's that. And, you know, so it's just, I guess it's just like, if it's helpful to you and it's helpful to other people, then it's a good thing. But
then whenever you post I appreciate the way that you use it. And I think a lot of artists use it that way and it's a healthy way to do it. You know, it's like a visual compendium as it is for many people who aren't artists as well. But when you post an image of your work, whether it's a finished piece or, you know, a work in progress, you know, you're putting it out there and you have an audience. Mm-hmm. And so your ego is going to tap into how popular that post was, inevitably.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's true, and I try not to zero in on that,
right?
Too much, but yeah, I guess it is unavoidable just because of the format of those platforms that you rack up these likes as points,
right?
Almost,
exactly.
That one got more than that one, you know.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of artists I know, you know, I've talked to them about it, it's just kind of a way of feeling less isolated in the studio.
Right.
Sometimes, you know,
right.
You just sort of did this, I'm putting it out there, just sharing like a moment from what I'm doing. And then, you know, ideally, you know, you get to have conversations in person about them with your colleagues when you
right.
run into them at the opening or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think that is ideally how it works. You know, it's a way of letting your friends and keep up with what you're doing, and then, you know, letting them know if you've got something coming up and, you know,
right.
things like that. So there's definitely pros and cons about it. And I think that it's good not to go into the studio and focus on those things.
Right.
Doing it after you're
right.
done for the day. Of
sure.
course, it doesn't always work that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Jim, I think we covered a fair amount. Thank you so much for talking to me, Jim. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
And we're out. Thank you very much again to Jim Gaylord for talking to me. And speaking of the real estate conversation that we're having around Brooklyn, gentrification, etc., maybe that would be a good podcast that covers that kind of thing, might be a good partner for a network. So if you know of any such podcasts, do let me know. Wanted to take this moment to let you know that this is a listener-supported show. That means that we do not have advertising right now, so the support that we get financially comes from you, the listener. If you have not donated the show, you like the show, and you would like to support it, go to theconversationpod.com/support and put in $12, $20, $30, $50 or more that if you can afford it and want to show your love. I do have Chris Ford, who I mentioned in the intro, and also Cooper Lovano, who are both helping me out for free to improve and streamline the show. And so if you were to donate, I would be able to pass some money along to them. In fact, you can earmark your donation towards them, and I will pass it along. So that would be a great way to help out the show. You can, of course, also spread the word. As I mentioned in the intro, we will be ideally sending out a survey, whether it's a SurveyMonkey or something similar soon. So if you are not on the donator email list and you would like to fill out a survey to let the podcast know what it can do to improve, do let us know and just give a shout through the website that you'd like to participate and with your email, and we will set you up on that list. But you can also support the show by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes, which is linked through the site, which gets more people to find the show. Of course, you can follow on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And you can like the show on Facebook. You make that 1,000th like, which is coming up fairly soon, and maybe a trip to Tahiti, maybe the Bahamas, maybe somewhere in the Caribbean. Or maybe just a fantastic shout out in some form. So who knows? You got to be the 1,000th fan to find out. All right. Thank you so much for being here. I think we will leave it there for now. And I will be talking to you next week with another episode. Let us know what you think of the show. And in the meantime, thank you so much for listening. I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.